This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Listen to us on KPFK, KPFA, and other Pacifica affiliates, and watch us on Free Speech TV Monday through Friday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. Reports have emerged since the Electoral College win of Donald Trump about Latino students being harassed by Trump supporters with chants of build a wall. One substitute teacher in Los Angeles was caught on tape threatening to turn a student's parents in to immigration authorities. Meanwhile, some local officials have been fighting back. LAPD Chief Charlie Beck said his officers would not assist in deportation efforts under Trump. Trump has made clear his administration would be deporting millions of undocumented immigrants. The fear in immigrant-heavy communities is palpable. The question is, how can people, particularly in diverse cities, push back? Joining me to help answer that question is Roberto Flores. He is a professor of Chicano studies at Cal State LA, a longtime Chicano activist based in Los Angeles, founder of Eastside Cafe, a space in El Sereno that was in part inspired by the Zapatistas. Welcome to the program, Roberto.
Thank you, Sonali. Glad
Thanks so
to be
much
here.
For joining us. Well, I've been asking one sort of set of questions to all of my guests since the election, which is, what are your general thoughts around the election of Trump before we get into the details? And how did you feel on election night? And I wanted to throw those out to you as well.
Now, why would you want to bring up a trauma like that?
Well, you know, I think we are all so traumatized trauma, collectively. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was traumatic. And even though there were all kinds of signs that could happen, you know, I go back to the whole thing that during the first the last few days, Trump was Hillary's momentum was lowered and Trump was gaining and gaining and gaining. So, you know, if he went with the momentum, you know, we thought, you know, that could be the result. It was traumatic because he's such a rightist dog. He's, you know, everything he stands for is insulting. And so you know, of course, you know, there's all kinds of mixed feelings because, you know, sometimes we have said we'd rather be told to our face than to be surprised and get somebody that's saying, you know, lying to us, you know, and acting like they're for us. And then in reality, they're not. So there's some. I guess we're trying psychologically to come to some kind of stability on this whole thing and get our footing again and move. So yeah, it was very traumatic.
What kinds of discussions have you been seeing in and around your community, politically active community, around Trump, and in particular the impact of Trump's win, which has emboldened racism, right? People are literally using Trump's name while they hurl abuses at vulnerable populations. I cited a couple of examples of young people, in particular children, being traumatized and harassed by people who are triumphant around a Trump win. Are you hearing any stories to that effect?
We're not hearing stories. The community I live in and relate to is El Sereno and in Los Angeles, and it's almost entirely Latino. There's a certain percentage of a growing Black population, some Asian, but it's mostly a mixture of immigrants and Chicanos. And so at the schools, there have been migra trucks parking different places and terrorizing the community, maybe intentionally or not intentionally.
Since the election?
right before the election. Right before the election.
And so, when you say MIGRA trucks, are you talking about Department of Homeland Security, Immigration ICE. Enforcement, ICE?
Right, right. And so there's, we haven't heard of any teachers or, you know, allowing, either doing or allowing any insults or anything that might traumatize the children. But we have been having a lot of discussions as to how we can prevent all this, how we can insulate the community, protect the community, and serve as an example as to maybe how other communities can do the same. Of course, we take into account California, what California is, and California, I believe, is 39% Latino. And
right. Is it the I believe it's the only state in the nation where Latinos are a plurality right now, and that actually whites are the white population is now second to the Latino population. Right. It's the only state in the nation where that's true.
I think so.
Yeah.
And that in itself, that demographic fact lends it provides a lot of protection. In and of itself, and there's a large percentage of elected officials, which we don't normally depend on. We don't depend on at all, actually. But at this time, there's several attitudes that we have towards politicians. One is don't depend on them, but the other is push them. Push them when we have to do what we need them to do. And at this point, what we're looking at the fact of the demographic fact. We're looking at the fact that the state itself, probably a lot because of this demographic fact, passed in 2013 a amnesty declaration as a state, and under Jerry Brown, and then the
so
city,
does that
of course,
mean that California is effectively a sanctuary state?
Well, in declaration. It is, but what we need to do is put some teeth. We have to define what sanctuary is from the bottom. And so this is the process that we're going through right now. We're trying to, because the city also declared itself sanctuary. And in response to that, ICE has written several memos as to what they'll do and what they won't do. But of course, they still have a lot of latitude to do a lot of bad things and traumatic things and terrorize the community. So what we're having to do is, as we put out, like, I don't know if you've seen USC, the UC system, the CSU system have put out statements regarding to address two students, especially undocumented students, letting them know that it's a safe campus.
These are USC, the state universities in California. Yeah, it's a pretty powerful statement.
Exactly. And so you're going to see this type of symbolic, quasi-symbolic type of gestures going on throughout. And but we want to define it more specifically. Mm. So we want to make sure that all public spaces are safe. Like, for instance, I think it was 2 years ago that the Walmart over in Azusa, I believe, was raided. And what the ICE did was that at a certain point, they went in there and they closed the doors. They locked all the doors. And then they arrested everybody that had no documents at that point. And so we want to make sure things like that do not occur. So it's not even, we want to expand what's there in terms of hospitals, schools, libraries, public places, government agencies, to public places like parks, stores, and so on, malls, where some of these raids could occur.
Right.
And so We want to make sure that the elected politicians feel pressure, feel the heat from the people, and define this in a very specific way.
Roberto, the issue of sanctuary cities is actually quite a national one. There have been several major cities in the country that have, even before this election, called themselves sanctuary cities. What that specifically means sort of depends from city to city. Donald Trump has said he will take aim at this. He has threatened to repeal federal funding for cities that call themselves sanctuary cities. We're talking about cities as big as Chicago. And of course, it's no coincidence that cities were among, you know, the most important centers of voting against Trump, right? Trump did not win in most cities. Most cosmopolitan major cities in the U.S. went Democratic this election, and those are the same kinds of cities that have large immigrant and Latino populations, and many of them call themselves sanctuary cities. This seems to be a model for sort of national organizing, I think, to say that, that people want to see cities as safe havens for immigrants. Could this be something that could gain momentum?
Yes, definitely. I think that the sanctuary movement needs to expand to all cities and beyond, wherever people are willing to carry that strategy and that method and build up that movement. And we think it's very effective. I think there's San Francisco. I think even Tucson is a sanctuary city within Arizona. Right. So those types of cities are it's really important, especially where they're in states where Trump won, need to be beefed up. The elected officials need to have a lot of pressure because they normally will sway, and that's our experience anyway. But I think that there's also a resolve from the from some of the elected Democratic operatives that they're going to stand up to this and so on. Right now, there's an anger. A resentment towards what's occurred, and of course, when you take in the whole thing of the popular vote, when you also take in the studies that were done that showed that Bernie Sanders could have won, you know, there's from the bottom there's a righteous anger towards all parties, right? At least the major both major parties, and that needs to be harnessed and paid attention to as well. So it's not just this anger for Trump. And a lot of people were sad that Trump won, but happy that Hillary lost. And so I think that we need to harness all that positive sentiment towards a government system, economic system that has been horrible. Has not been taking care of the needs of the people and have been mainly going towards the needs of the wealthy.
Right. I mean, we should remind ourselves that under President Obama, we saw record numbers of deportations. And so certainly, I think, tamped down some of the enthusiasm for a Clinton presidency, which promised to be a continuation of Obama. We brought up the issue of Arizona, and I think Arizona offers a really interesting lesson on a local level during this election. One of the small bright spots for progressives on 11-9 was the fact that Sheriff Joe Arpaio of Maricopa County lost his seventh term. This was a huge victory for local activists in Arizona who spent many years trying to oust him. What lessons can that fight hold for us? And Arpaio is horribly notorious. He may actually be part of a new Trump cabinet.
Right. I think that the analysis that this is even Chomsky's analysis is that this is kind of like the last gasp of white supremacy type of capitalism. Corporate capitalism is an important analysis, and the benefits of also paying a lot of attention to local struggles, and the benefits that can come out of that. So there's a negative that weighs on us heavy because it's Arpaio might be in charge of Homeland Security, and that's going to be horrible. But back on this, we're also encouraging everyone, including politicians, to take a stand. And at a state level, we have a lot to go in terms of making California autonomous. And
are you talking about CalExit? Then there is an actual real effort called Yes California that says on the 2018 ballot will be a measure where Californians can choose to secede from the U.S.
Right. Well, secession and autonomy are a little different, but okay. I understand the sentiment. And but I think there's a lot of room. See, secession would be a harder and a longer battle and may be right and may not be right.
And it would be one more border in a place, you know, where right. We have maybe too many borders
exactly.
already.
Exactly. If the motive, if the intent is racist, then it's going to be wrong, you know. And if the intent is to set up an example and to be of what a country should be, then that would be a correct thing to do. But even then, I'm talking about now. What can we do now? There's a lot of leeway. There's an willingness, I think. You look at Jerry Brown's character. You look at a person that's not going to take a lot of mandates Trump. And so we want to encourage that. We want to encourage as much autonomy as possible. If Trump takes away federal monies because we're a sanctuary state, well, then let's discuss whether we want to pay federal money in the income tax in terms of because we're not getting any federal money back.
And California is the fifth largest economy in the world, and with its giant population, it could very easily be a country in itself.
Exactly. And also, because of that, it could insulate us in such a way that it could, for instance, Obamacare goes out, CaliforniaCare comes in. The federal monies go out, California supplements and supplements come in to hold up the standard of living and go beyond, because this is going to push us beyond what we have right now, because we're defending our rights to there's been 10 immigration bills or more in the last couple of years. There's a Assemblywoman Loretta Gonzalez, I think, from San Diego, and many others from here. AB 60, AB 1154, 59, AB 1154, I think, many different immigrant rights bills. This could push us. This effort will bring us together in such a way where it'll push us towards even advancing and expanding immigrant rights like they should be, and doing things, you know, preparing ourselves to do things as an independent state. And as an autonomous state as much as possible without seceding and without having to take those votes and that process. It can be done now.
Okay, so Roberto, those of my listeners, my audience outside of California listening to you going, wait, what about us? What about the rest of the country?
Exactly. So what this is going to inspire, though, is a disobedience. A righteous disobedience to do the right thing. And it's going to serve as an example to other politicians in other places. And it may even encourage people to move in some cases from areas. And we have to be ready. We have to be ready. If this becomes the fascism that Trump promises, then we have to be ready to bring people into California. You know,
and of course, people who live in immigrant-heavy communities know that immigrants are, by and large, assets, right? Trump was able to point to isolated incidents over the past several years of, you know, a person here or there who might have committed a heinous crime and happened to be an undocumented immigrant. Obviously, you know, you're going to have that in any community of any people, any demographic you look at. But by and large, overall, we've had study after study showing that undocumented immigrants, people who may have maybe DACA recipients, et cetera, tend to be a big asset to the community economically, culturally. So that could actually be a very positive thing for California.
Yes, definitely. On the other side, we're looking at how far they can go. And we were just talking about the possibility that we were wondering, why is Donald Trump quoting 3 million people? You know,
are you talking about plan for the first 100 days? I think he says something like deporting 2 million criminal illegal immigrants, quote unquote.
Yes, he's mentioned 2 million and 3 million at 60 Minutes. He mentioned 3 million. And we're wondering, well, where's he getting these numbers? And we're even thinking, and this is just conjecture to a certain degree, we're thinking that possibly he's thinking of increasing immigration from Eastern Europe while he deports people from Latin America.
You mean immigrants like his wife?
Immigrants like his wife.
And white immigrants?
Yes. So, which will make America white again.
I mean, this is speculation, so we don't really know. And so,
it's speculation. We're not sure. But this would be I don't want to give Trump any ideas, but we're thinking that this may be one of the things that he's thinking of doing, because we're thinking, where does he get this 3 million number? 2 or 3 million? Is it because Obama? It was a deporter in chief and deported that many people. Or is it something else? And we're thinking, well, in order to stabilize the economy, understanding that if he lessens the population of immigrant workers by 3 million, he would hurt the economy if he doesn't replace them. So we're just kind of thinking possibilities ahead.
Now, we mentioned Arpaio having a future in a Trump presidency as a possible, he's been touted as possible head of the Department of Homeland Security. What could that possibly mean? Because I think it's important for us to identify, for those people who hadn't been paying attention to his antics in Maricopa County, very localized effort. Can you give us a sense of what he did, how he humiliated not just undocumented people, but brown-skinned people in general, with his use of, chain gangs and these just really terrible language? He was charged with contempt of court several times. He basically seems to be a kind of person for whom legalities and ethics are just nuisances.
They are. In terms of the law, it's the law is for others to obey and for him to disinterpret and not for him to follow. So he does what he wants. He dressed people up in pink, walked them through the streets.
Right. He had a line of pink underwear that he would sell. And exactly. This was underwear that he would make prisoners wear as a way to, I'm guessing, emasculate the male prisoners and humiliate them.
Right. And so he's a horrible sadist who fascist, and that's not an understatement. If you can ask the people from Arizona, and people are extremely happy to have gotten rid of, but unfortunately
he might be kicked upstairs, as they say. Well, another figure that Arizona produced, Chris Kobach, who was the author of SB 1070, one of the most virulently racist state laws that very basically just legalized or attempted to legalize racial profiling. He's been touted as attorney general under Donald Trump. So between Joe Arpaio as head of Homeland Security and Chris Kobach as Attorney General, if those two appointments actually materialize, immigrants are in big, big trouble, undocumented folks. Kobach has said nobody living here illegally will get a, quote, free pass, and predicted many immigrants would leave as jobs and benefits, quote, dry up. I'm not sure what he means by that, but remind us what Kobach represents.
Yes. As a matter of fact, one of the guidelines, it's almost like a reverse guideline that we're probably going to look at in terms of defining what sanctuary is to do all the opposite things, to make sure that people are in safe places where the types of things that he wanted to do not happen, like doctors and nurses obligated to tell on their patients, teachers, family members, taxi drivers. Now it's going to be Uber, Tesla, and all the other Lyft drivers that are going to be obligated.
Right, because for transporting an undocumented person, you basically could face criminal charges. And then, of course, we have the undoing of the very modest programs that President Obama put in place, the main one being DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. I actually met a DACA recipient at the anti-Trump rally on Saturday who, you know, was very upset and traumatized, who said, you know, I work very hard, I put myself through UCLA, I pay my taxes. That they've already promised they're going to undo that. Obama, but because of the Republicans, was never able to put in a DAPA in place, the one for parents of naturalized citizens. What will happen to all of these DACA recipients?
There's a couple of points concerning.
And by the way, just to interject here, DACA recipients have had to turn their information over to the government, and many people feared having done that. Now the government knows who they are.
Right, AB-60 as well. When you go to, you know, you go take a test for a license, you have to hand in information.
This was the driver's licenses for immigrants in California.
Now we begin to define sanctuary. Governor Brown has to say he will not give up any of that information. And
is the DACA information something that states have, though, or the federal government?
The AB 60. And in terms of DACA and DAPA, I think there needs to be some amount of thinking in terms of what particular type of intervention and security will have to be given to those folks. A change of address, maybe something has to be done. And what we're thinking also is that if DACA and DAPA are completely taken out, then it's going to be California-based DACA, California-based DAPA. So this is where we're thinking that we have to push the state to its natural demographic dictated equilibrium.
Got it. Well, Roberto, I thank you for putting that idea out there, and we certainly hope it proliferates. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sonali.
Roberto Flores is a professor of Chicano Studies at Cal State LA, longtime Chicano activist based in Los Angeles, founder of the East Side Cafe. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can find our interviews online at risingupwithsonali.com and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.